I'm not by any means trying to say that actual mothering is not a very valuable way that some women live out their obedient faith. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that what's blessed about that is the faithfulness rather than the activity. And here we're looking at some other activities that women have been engaged in the last two centuries in our North American context to see what we can learn from them about our own faithfulness, our own living according to God's commands. Yesterday we looked at Lucretia Mott, an early 19th century Quaker preacher, and I suggested that she was a practical prophet who spoke to the unrighteousness in her world and endeavored to correct it. Unlike what our expectations often are of prophets, she was not an alienated character. She wasn't like John the Baptist going around in ragged fur garments and eating wild locusts. She had quiet, somber Quaker clothing, although she did have one bonnet she wore that got her in trouble with the Society of Friends because it was a little bit too flashy. And it was a gift to her, and so she wore it. This got her in trouble. But she wasn't alienated, and so I suggested, along with a description of her as a practical prophet, that we can think of her as a householder, one who took responsibility for her society as well as for her home, that her home was not a refuge from the world, but a point of gathering and intersection. She used her resources of family, confidence, and privilege toward the reform of society, toward what she saw as the kingdom of God. Lucretia Mott was not really someone who experienced a great deal of oppression. She was a woman of great privilege in her society, but she was a good steward of that privilege. Today we look at a different woman, and you should have these green sheets that have a picture of Amanda Berry Smith. Amanda Berry Smith was born in 1837 when Lucretia Mott was in her 40s and well into her anti-slavery activity. It was 3 years before Lucretia Mott traveled to London for the World Anti-Slavery Convention that Amanda Berry Smith was born. Smith received a call to preach in about 1870, and again, for a bit of comparison, that was about a decade before Mott died. Smith lived until 1915. The primary source of information about Amanda Berry Smith is this little book. I've written the title up here, An Autobiography, The Story of the Lord's Dealings with Mrs. Amanda Smith, the Colored Evangelist. And that's her vocabulary. I think it's important to realize that a woman in the late 19th century would call herself colored. That was the contemporary vocabulary. This has been issued, reissued by the Oxford University Press series called the Schomburg Library of 19th Century Black Women Writers. So it is available and it is in print, and it has a helpful introduction that places Amanda Berry Smith in the context of women preachers in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. That's the focus of the introduction. Any of you who subscribe to Lutheran Women Today, if you remember this issue, I have a little piece in there about Amanda Berry Smith, so if the name sounds familiar, it may be that you read about her in here. Okay. One other resource, if you're interested in her, there is a volume called Women in New Worlds, published by the Methodist Publishing House. I can't remember the name. And there's an essay in there about Amanda Berry Smith. Unlike Mott, who was sometimes called the black man's goddess, Amanda Berry Smith was not privileged, and nor was she really supported by her family. Reading her autobiography, I was struck by how few ongoing connections with people there are. And as I read women's autobiography, I'm always looking for stuff about their connections to family and their connections with other people, how they use their real relationships to help them understand their religious being or their spirituality, how they use that metaphor. When we come later in the week to talk about Dorothy Day, one of the things I find fascinating about Dorothy Day in her autobiography is three times she refers to herself as a barren woman made a mother. Okay. But in the case of Amanda Berry Smith, there's not a lot about her family. If Mott was called by some of her contemporaries the black man's goddess, Frances Willard, the longtime president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, called Amanda Berry Smith an African Sibyl and a Christian saint. So you get these funny little things people call them. Also, in contrast to Mott, in Berry we don't find, Smith, we don't find a systematic analysis of what's wrong in society. We can't really call Smith a reformer, a social reformer, in the sense that someone like Mott was, that she belonged to zillions of organizations, that she was always going to meetings, and that her religiosity, her religiousness, her piety, her spirituality, whatever word you want to use to describe that, was very quiet, as a Quaker meeting is quiet, and very stable and consistent, something that I think is characteristic of Quaker spirituality. Smith, on the other hand, is a woman whose own search for holiness, her personal search for holiness, pushed her into activities that were not expected of a formally uneducated black woman. Okay, so she had several things that would have, that we might expect to have disqualified her from being a preacher. And that's really what we must remember her of. That's how she describes herself, as an evangelist, a carrier of good news. She was relatively uneducated. Her formal schooling amounted to, you know, a few months. She was taught to read by her parents at home. She was black, and she was a woman. There is, however, an important similarity between these two first figures in that both of them take their authority from the spirit. For Mott, that's the divine light that is within you. Smith would talk about it more in terms of the spirit of God. She comes out of the holiness tradition. I'll say a little more about that later. But before I tell you more about Smith's life, I'd like you to take maybe 5 or 6 minutes to just skim through these excerpts from her autobiography. Later we'll look at them and read some pieces aloud, but take about 5 minutes to just skim over it. And if there are extra copies, it looks like one person back here didn't get it.
You've got back page and not front page.
Okay, I don't know where the piles are. There should be even numbers. There should be. Maybe they're pushed together? The back?
No.
The front page should have a picture. Kinko's screwed up. Oh, you have two fronts. That explains.
She has two fronts.
Okay, here's another set.
I took the same because I'm taking one.
The front, if you got a front.
And there's another page besides this?
Yeah. Here, I'll trade you.
Oh.
See, you should have two that are different.
Oh, I see.
You have just the front. There's the back.
Oh, thank you.
Now I'm down to just one front.
I'll take it.
I'm sorry, there aren't quite enough to go around. And that reminds me to ask you, when you leave, unless you think you'll have use for the handout, to please return them, because I'm going to repeat this series and I'll need to use the handouts again. What you have there is, first of all, an account of her conversion and then an account of her call to preach. About these women and as you read their words, and those are, what about this woman do you admire? What about her do you find troublesome? And thirdly, what would you like to emulate about her? I don't expect that any of these five are the exact pattern for either you or I of how we're going to live our lives. But there may be pieces that we would like to incorporate into our own lives of faithfulness. Okay. Bela, could you start the tape again, please? Beginning to see the whites of some of your eyes, so I think that at least a few of you have finished and perhaps you've at least gotten a flavor of the way Amanda Smith presented her own life. There's a methodological debate that goes on about using autobiography as a source for doing any kind of historical work. And the question, of course, is how true is what you read? How true is the story that we tell about ourselves? And where I come down in that argument is always to say that autobiography is like your letters from your friends. And you know that your friends shape what they tell you. You know that sometimes you can trust their account more than others. But what you're interested in, as much as the accuracy of their account, is their perception and the way they're making sense out of what's happening to them. And so I think that autobiography is particularly a fruitful source for us to understand how someone struggled to be transformed into God's image. Let me tell you a little something about the times in which Amanda Berry Smith was active and something about her life. First of all, just very few words about American Black religion. One of the big debates about Black American religion is how much of it is Africanisms, how much has adhered in Africans' being that is African religion, and how does that get grafted on to Christianity? I'm not sure we can answer that question. It's important when we look at Amanda Smith, not so much because of how she lived out her own religion, which seems to be just right down the middle of the AME, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the holiness tradition. It's more important because of reminding us that one of the places she was active as an evangelist was Sierra Leone and Liberia. And she seemed to think, along with many, many, many other Black Americans of her time, that they had a special responsibility to take the gospel to Africa, because that was their home place. And Sierra Leone and Liberia are a special case, of course, because that's one of the colonization areas for freed slaves. Remember yesterday I said something about the Mots being gradually convinced that colonization, recolonization, was not the way to go. Nonetheless, throughout the century, there continued to be some return to Africa from North America of Black Americans going to Africa to live, and that's one of the places where Smith preached. Other issues have to do to ask if Blacks were attracted to certain kinds of religion. Were they more attracted to the emotionalism of revivalism? You know, why was it that all the Blacks seemed to become Methodists and Baptists, and why didn't they become Congregationalists? Well, I have a theory about that. It's that the Congregationalists were in New England, and most of the slaves were in the South, where a lot of the white people were also Methodists and being influenced by revivalism. And so if you go to New Orleans, for example, there are a lot of Black Catholics in New Orleans. think it's true that we are attracted to what we're offered. And to a large degree, what was being offered to slaves was Methodist and Baptist Christianity rather than some of the more subdued kinds of Christianity. At the same time, we do have to acknowledge that people who are in oppressed situations frequently, not because they've come from Africa with some genetic desire for ecstatic religion, but because of a situation of physical, economic, day-to-day oppression, find a great release in a spiritualist kind of religion. So there may be some connection there. I don't know enough to be able to say this is why it happened. I just want to present to you some of the alternatives. In the case of Amanda Berry Smith, Christianity had a very important role to play early in her life. She is the child of two slaves who were owned by two neighboring slave owners. And there were five children born into that family before her mother's owner came to the point of death. Her father had purchased his own freedom. He saved money from doing chores, certain kinds of work that he got paid for, had purchased his own freedom. The mother and the five children were still held as slaves. And then the mistress of that family, out of religious conviction, perhaps delayed religious conviction, but out of religious conviction nonetheless, freed the five children and the mother into the care of the husband and father shortly before her death. So it was a Christian impulse. We might argue that she could have done it a little sooner, but she did do it. And I think that had some effect on how they understood things. Once the whole family was freed, they moved from Maryland up into Pennsylvania, the area of York, Pennsylvania. One of the things I've always been curious about with them is that York, Pennsylvania is a stronghold of Lutheranism. It's where the Muhlenberg family was and the Schmuckers. And I always wondered if there's any connection, you know, if any of the Berry children worked in those homes. But I don't know. I'm just real curious about that. In the York area, the family was active in their church. They were active in the Underground Railroad. Amanda gives an exciting account of people coming to look for slaves hidden in their house when she was a child. She herself started working out as a domestic pretty early in her teenage years and was married at age 17 to a man named Calvin Devine, who went off to join the Union Army and never came back. We don't know if he was killed or, you know, decided to go to Ohio, or, I mean, we don't know what happened to him. He just disappeared. Several of her brothers, eventually there were 13 children, I think 13 children in the family. Several of her brothers served in the Union Army. But she has astonishingly little in her autobiography about the Civil War. It doesn't really figure in her own recollection of her life. She had two children by her first husband. The first one died in infancy, and the second one died when she was about 20 years, when the child was about 20 years old. In 1856, so she was about 20 years old, she experienced the conversion that you read about on the first two pages. It's a very interesting conversion story. The struggle with God. But at the same time, we read about her will, which you don't often read about in stories of revivalistic conversions. It's her will that's involved as much as the Spirit taking over. At this point, I guess I would ask if you have comments or questions you'd like to ask about that conversion narrative. or pieces you found particularly intriguing you'd like to read out loud. One of the things we read about Amanda Smith in the contemporary literature is that she had a beautiful contralto voice. They always comment on that, so when I read this, I wish I could hear her voice. Steve?
Yes, I was struck by the issue of obedience. And I don't know what conclusion to draw from that, but that was the issue.
Mm-hmm. And obedience, that the obedience was to God.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the context where she was a servant to other people.
Right.
And for a long time, that's a struggle in her life, that she has those two kinds of obedience. Even though she's not legally a slave, her condition as a poor black woman means that she's dependent on washing. And there's, again, in her autobiography later, when she's in New York City, an exchange she has with a woman about doing laundry and how much this woman will pay her. And she thinks she should get a dollar, and the woman offers her, you know, 50 cents. And this, she said, I only have 7 cents. I really needed more money than that.
A couple of comments, just in reading through it so quickly. I liked the where she started out and said, I don't mean to ever go forward to the altar. I mean, there was no intention at all. And so even though it was will, it was also a compelling, I don't mean to. And then also just the kind of levels in first-class families and the different levels that I had no knowledge of. And I don't know how historical it is, except that she makes the comments. And then also I love the figuring in of the ironing board.
Yeah.
And then she passes by the altar. I mean, it's almost as if it's an altar or a place, and she mentions the ironing board. And it's captured there for us to read today.
Yeah. And another thing that I would like to draw your attention to is on the first page with her picture, in the second column, the second paragraph from the bottom. If I had known how to exercise faith, I would have found peace that night, but they did not instruct us intelligently. So I was left in the dark. Even in a tradition like the AME and later the Holiness tradition that emphasizes the work of the Spirit, she has a sense that it's not all her. And somebody should have told her. She should have had instruction that would help her learn. And I think, although she doesn't draw the connection, the fact that she becomes an evangelist, a kind of teacher, is important and significant, that her response then is to help other people, to instruct them, and bring them to a point of holiness.
She's very intentional also. I just had to chuckle when she said here, I had planned just about how I was going to be converted. I mean, she just made this decision.
I'm going to have these great clothes.
This is the way it's going to be.
Yes.
In her autobiography, does she bring up this near-death experience? Does it carry on through with her? I mean, she makes quite a story, and people who have near-death experiences, you know, will talk about how it influences decisions, choices, and I was just wondering if she does that anymore in her book.
Not a lot. This autobiography is not very self-reflective. It's much more accounting. This happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. Some later women's autobiographies are much more reflective about how things happened and why they happened. But I think pointing to the near death is a significant thing, and throughout the history of Christian life, we often find that illness or pain or suffering at a point of transition. Vita Scudder, one of the other women we'll look at, has a nervous, kind of a nervous breakdown after she'd been teaching a few years. And that at that point, she said, well, all I could do was lay in my room, so I figured I might as well learn how to pray. And that was the point where she changes. Teresa of Avila is another one, a medieval Spanish woman who, she has such a near-death experience that they had her laying out in the chapel, and the wax, hot wax, fell on her and woke her up. I mean, so it can, and it's an interesting theme to continue with, to see how women or Christians in general respond to pain or suffering, and if they take it as a point of opportunity, this is my opportunity to learn something, or if they take it as a trial or a test. David?
I was struck by her relationship with the sun and the moon and the stars, and that they were, how she had given them human qualities, and in fact it's in praying. Was it to the sun to mediate to Jesus? I wonder if that maybe was some of her Africanisms.
Yeah, do you think she was praying to the sun?
Talking to it anyhow.
Yeah.
All at once it came to me.
Yeah, I would
pray to the moon, pray to the sun, pray to the stars.
But I would guess that it was more.
Oh, moon and stars, you never sinned like me. You have always obeyed God. Right. And kept your place in the heavens. Tell Jesus I am a good sinner.
She was certainly addressing them. But it's not the kind of nature religion where you look at the moon and the moon from the moon you learn. But I already know about Jesus, and therefore when I look at the moon, I understand the moon as being something that's always faithful. Do you see the difference? That I don't want you to make her into a nature mystic, I guess is what I'm saying.
Is the conversion experience that sees the issue as obedience and things being in their place make it difficult or make it less likely that she would be a reformer? I mean, in one sense, it seems as though what her conversion enabled her to do was sort of accept her place.
Yeah.
And somehow cope with that.
Okay, oppression. That's a good transition point, Steve, to go then back to her life story and what happens after this. This conversion she experienced, as I said, in about 56. Yeah. She moved to Philadelphia, where she became a member of Bethel AME, which is one of the congregations of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. There she met and married a man named James Smith, so Barry was her birth name, who was a deacon at Old Bethel. And there was some misunderstanding there about what he was going to do and what his career was going to be. And I think Amanda thought he was more of a churchman than he really was, and she had some disappointments about that. Again, she had bore two more children who died in infancy and a third who lived to be a small child. James and Amanda moved to New York City. Briefly, her husband was there, and then he moved away out into the country in New York, leaving Amanda and Will in the city by themselves. She was working again as a domestic, as a washerwoman, taking in laundry, going out to work in people's houses, and going to church all the time. So there's this sort of Benedictine way of life, that you pray and you work. You pray and you work, but not always separate. And because I knew where to find it in here rather than dig around in the autobiography, let me read you a few sentences that she used as she described this time in her life. "For I found that it was not necessary to be a nun or be isolated away in some deep retirement to have communion with Jesus. But though your hands are employed in doing your daily business, it is no bar to the soul's communion with Jesus. Many times over my washtub and ironing table, again, and while making my bed and sweeping my house and washing my dishes, I have had some of the richest blessings." There is a kind of acceptance of what her life is. An acceptance of it being filled up. And I don't want to be an essentialist and say women do it this way and men do it that way, but there certainly is something striking about some studies I've seen of religious women that there tends to be a kind of spirituality that women manifest, which is a filling up of what you do. Whatever it is you do is given more meaning rather than changing to something else. And one of the, if you're interested in that notion, one of the people who makes the argument, I think, very persuasively on the basis of some medieval mystics is Carolyn Bynum, B-Y-N-U-M, in a book called Holy Feast, Holy Fast. Just, it's really about food and their spirituality, but she does make that argument. One of the meetings that, religious meetings that Amanda Smith was attending in New York City in this time period were the Tuesday meetings led by Phoebe Palmer, one of the early leaders of the Holiness movement. Holiness is something that grew out of Methodism. John Wesley, who was a revivalist, was concerned that after you experience God's grace, you grow in sanctification, so that there's an ongoing move toward perfection. And the Holiness movement makes that even more explicit, so that there's a conversion, a sort of a first conversion and a second conversion. The first conversion is what you read about. Holiness is when you come to perfection, and you're sanctified is also a term that's used sometimes, that you receive sanctification or baptism in the Spirit, something like that. Holiness does not always involve glossolalia, speaking in tongues, or healing, although that Pentecostal movement is another step in the same progression. Because she started going to these Tuesday meetings with Phoebe Palmer, Amanda Smith will, throughout the rest of her life, walk between traditions. She is a member of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. She will work with Methodist white Methodist missionaries primarily in Africa, in India, in England. But she also has these connections to the Holiness community. So she doesn't reside so much in the center of something as she walks the boundaries between them. In September of 1868, she experienced entire sanctification or perfection. It's the second stage. Shortly thereafter, her baby, Will, died, and her husband died. And then this left her, on the one hand, you could say, without support, but since these people were more sucking life out than supporting her, it also left her free to go on and go away. So she didn't have to work to take care of a baby anymore. She didn't have to work to take care of her husband and give him money and try and figure out what was going on there. So in 1870, at the urging of one of her white employers, she went off to attend a Holiness camp meeting. And that's partly what you read there on the final page. Camp meetings were becoming increasingly popular in the late 19th century. Going to a different place, having a prolonged meeting for several days with a lot of preaching, a time of heightened religious awareness. And so she went to these. And that's where she received this call to preach. And finally, she gave up working as a domestic servant and became an evangelist full-time. And that's what we read about here. Her call, I think, is a very interesting one. I don't personally know anyone who's had a call like that, that was so clear. Yeah. Yeah, right. And I suppose, for me, this is both something that I admire and something that's troublesome. You know, I admire it because it's so clear. And on the other hand, it's a little troublesome because I'm suspicious. because I'm not that kind of person. You note also that she had some resistance from within her tradition, from this man you read about, Brother Holland, who used to be my pastor 8 years before in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Well, sister, you know I don't believe in women preaching. But still, honey, I have got nothing to say about you. You go. The Lord bless you. This is a difficult thing with the holiness tradition. If those who are unusual are able to preach because the Spirit calls them, it only helps that person. It doesn't change the system. Okay? So Amanda Smith can go out and preach, but she's not particularly worried about other women being able to preach. She does have, I don't want to sell her short, she does attend meetings of the AME, big meetings, and she does talk about it. And we have to say that when the biggest discussion of it was going on, she was in Africa, so it's not her fault that she didn't do something about it. So the one thing was that she was a woman preaching. She was not without antecedents. There were other women, Jerina Lee, who had done this. There were contemporaries of her who had also done it. That's one thing, that she was a woman preaching. Second thing is that she was a black woman. And she preached to mixed audiences, both blacks and whites, and she preached to white audiences for several years, up and down the coast from Maine to Tennessee. And some of her black colleagues, or I don't know how to describe them exactly, were very critical of her for this. And they called her, she says it right in her autobiography, they called her a white person's nigger because she preached to white people. On the other hand, she also gives accounts of a couple of occasions where she thought God had really used her to help white people over their prejudice about her race. So she sees herself doing that a little bit. She's not an activist, but rather she views herself as God's instrument in that work. Okay. Then her international career. In 1878, she set sail for England and Scotland. Again, the holiness people hosted her and took her around, and she spoke. Now, Jerry asked, he's not here today, but this last time about Lucretia Mott. Were these white abolitionists controlling the black abolitionists? In this case, we might want to ask, you know, was she being exploited? Here, former black slave from America comes and preaches the gospel. In India, we know that she was advertised that way. She went from London to India. Perhaps that was the thing that made her remarkable. That's why people came, perhaps. It's not what she preached about. And I think, for to say, what do you want to emulate? For me, one of the things I want to emulate about Amanda Berry Smith is to remember that I get to do some things because I'm a woman. They need a woman on that committee. So, well, let's get Deanne. She'll do it. Am I being exploited? Gee. Or am I being given an opportunity to be a steward of what I have? I'm not sure Amanda Berry Smith gives me the answer for that, but she does make me think about why we get chosen to do things. And sometimes it's not because of our gifts or anything that we're in control of, but that's the piece that gets us started. She was in India for 2 years, and then she went to Liberia and Sierra Leone for 8 years. And I wish she would have written a lot more about what she did when she was in Africa. Those of you who have seen The Color Purple will remember, or who have read The Color Purple, remember there is that part about Nettie who goes to Africa as a missionary, and unfortunately that hasn't been made as much of as the Seeley half of the story. The way it comes out in the film is even less helpful, I think, than how it comes out in the book. There were a lot of people like Nettie and her family who were in Africa doing mission work. And what is very interesting about the way Amanda Berry Smith functioned in Sierra Leone and Monrovia is that she became concerned there with temperance and education. And she was very worried, extremely concerned, about American blacks who moved to Liberia or Sierra Leone and weren't prepared, that they weren't sent a good list of the things you need to bring, that they didn't have schools, that they couldn't take care of themselves, that they became prey to alcohol. And those were the things that she seemed to work on in Africa much more than she had before. And I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because then there's some connection to the community that she didn't have in the United States. She doesn't tell us. We can guess. We can speculate. And as I said before, really the people she worked with as colleagues tended to be the white Methodists and often the British Methodists. And the people she worked with as, could we say, clients were the formerly American blacks. It's interesting, we have to call them, instead of African-American, American Africans. She came back to the United States in 1890. She brought with her, by way of England, where she left this little boy in school, a native boy who she had adopted. And when she returned to the U.S., she's somewhat less active. She moved to Chicago for a while, where the speculation is perhaps she moved there because she had some connection with Frances Willard. And that's what drew her to Chicago. But she went to Harvey, a suburb. There she wrote her autobiography. She founded an orphanage for black children. And recently Newsweek had a big article about the poorest suburbs in the United States. And I kept thinking, Harvey, why have I heard of Harvey? And then as I was getting ready to do this, I remembered, that's where the orphanage was. It was in Harvey. The state wanted to close the place down when she retired to Florida, and they couldn't because there was no other facility in Illinois for black orphans. So it continued despite the fact that it was not up to standards. And it was known for a while as the industrial school for girls. She died in Florida in 1915 of a paralytic stroke and was returned to Chicago, where she's buried in Chicago. Before I make some summary kinds of statements about what I think is the significance of Amanda Berry Smith, let me again give you an opportunity, if you're ready, to name the things about this woman that you find admirable, that you find troublesome, or that you want to emulate. If you're not ready, I'm not too worried about that. I think it will keep on in your brain after you leave here. But if you have some that are ready and would like to share with us, please do.
I'm always struck by the courage of people who are willing to travel, mm-hmm. especially in that, I mean, to go to England, I mean...
By steamship.
Yeah, by steamship, to go to, I mean, to... I mean, I don't know if we can ever identify with what kind of courage that took to do that.
Mm-hmm. It looked like you were about ready to say something.
I'm just sitting here thinking, I grew up in the holiness movement. My great-grandmother went to China in 1900 by herself. And so I just feel a lot of points of connection with that whole story.
Do you know that the book and the film, is it In of the Sixth Happiness? About Chinese, it's a woman who goes from England to be a missionary in China. It's that same kind of profoundly personal spiritual call that gave her courage to go against, you know, everyone said, you can't go, you don't know enough, we're not going to send you. So she got on the train across Russia and went.
And I have a comment just about that too, because I think of all the, within our Lutheran tradition, and what women were doing a little bit later than what was going on. But the women who did answer a call, and there's great stories also. I'm curious about this G.O. And I remember one woman, and I can't remember her name, but she saw it written in the clouds, and it told her to go to China. Now, she was a strong Norwegian Lutheran woman in the early part of this century, and so it was that inner calling. But again, there wasn't any activism that came out of that. And to go to serve in Alaska was an inner thing out of our Lutheran tradition, and there was no other opportunity. But that individualized answer to a call. And then, all like you say, I'm skeptical. I'm interested in the G.O. and the clouds and what that really was. But it was certainly a call.
Others. There are ways that Amanda Berry Smith can teach you something that you need to know, something that say, oh yeah, I can be like that. Just one of those. I've heard Mayor LaGuardia of New York described as marginal man, in that he lived both in the Jewish and Italian immigrant communities, and he was conversant with the good government people, so that he was at the margins between lots of places. He wasn't really in the center of any of them. I think I've used him often as an example when I talk about the Apostle Paul, who I think in many ways was also marginal. He was a Jew, but he was a Jew from the seacoast. So he wasn't a Jerusalem Jew. He was a Jew from the provinces. He was working with the Gentiles. He was between places. And in some ways, I see lots of parallels between Amanda Berry Smith and someone like Paul, whose identity finally comes primarily from her spiritual commitments. She goes back and forth between kinds of communities. She provides a sort of bridge, allows us to have hope that maybe we can speak to people who are different from us. Maybe we can hear from people who are different from us. Maybe we can learn those things. And in a way, her sacrifice to get that was that her identity was as an individual. Real, very much in contrast to Lucretia Mott, who I would argue her strength comes from the fact that she's so well grounded in a community. It's odd that Amanda Smith seems to have her strength from the fact that she's separated from all of these communities and tenuously connected to them. Two different kinds of models, both of which take as their center strong confidence in God's calling. Quaker way of seeing it and a holiness way of seeing it, but both share that in common. So I would give as a tag to Amanda Berry Smith what she gave herself. She's an evangelist. A person called by the Spirit to carry good news. That's primarily what she did. And I would say that it's important that she was a woman, that the call was strong enough that when people said to her, "You can't do it because it's a, because you're a woman," she went back to Galatians. There, right there, same thing people are doing 100 years later. She goes back to Galatians. I think it's important that she was a black woman, that she was not confined, however, either to the sphere of women or to the sphere of blacks, but that she did have a connection to Africa. She didn't cut herself off from either Africa or the black community, as we see in her later life with her orphanage. And that all of that comes together, that she's a woman led by the Spirit of God. So, tomorrow we'll look at Vida Scudder, go again back to a woman of privilege, a woman who was an English instructor at Wellesley College, interested in socialism, pacifism, and Franciscan spirituality. So, thank you.